Coaching as Benevolence, a podcast for people who are curious about using coaching for self-development. I'm Erin with Roots and Wings Grief and Loss Coaching.
And I'm LaShawn with Michelle Sage Place Positive Intelligence Coaching. Today, we have a very special guest, Ryan Forbes. He is a writer, podcaster, and Lorax. Like the Lorax speaking for the trees, he speaks for the incarcerated and gives a voice to issues that we may not be listening to. He's the host and founder of the Shakedown podcast. And Ryan, we would love for you to tell us more about yourself. What can you tell our listeners?
Well, like you said, I am the host of The Shakedown. Basically, my podcast is about criminal justice. It's about explaining how the criminal justice system works and what we can do to improve it. I have a lot of firsthand experience with that because in 2014, I caused a crash, which ended up costing a young man his life. And then I spent 6 years in Texas prison. And then after I got released, I got released right in the midst of kind of that weird post-COVID timing. From all that, I learned about how the criminal justice system worked. And when I was trying to do what I thought was the right thing, it's just not how the justice system worked. And I don't want anyone to have to go through what I went through for that. And I also saw what was happening inside, and I don't want anyone to go through that either. And I also, I learned about different types of justice, including restorative justice. I just released a graphic novel about restorative justice based in part upon my story and also what it would look like if there was a restorative justice approach available and how that could actually be used to help the victims. Because that's another group that really gets hurt by our current justice system is victims aren't given a lot of choice or a lot of options. So restorative justice is really helpful because it gives the victims a choice in what they can get. And there's a free version on my site, Way WordPress, which is like a way with words, waywordpress.com. And I do the podcast. I've been writing, just finished the graphic novel. I'm actually going to start on a new book, kind of summarizing, like going through all of these topics so I can be like, here is like the full, like if anyone needs the information, this is where you can go. And I've just started working on that. But I also help people learn about podcasting, learn about getting their channels on YouTube as well, trying to help people in general.
And can you tell us a little bit more about your podcast?
Yes. So the Shakedown started with myself and two of my friends who were also released from Texas prison around the same time that I was. One of them was my buddy Malone. Malone spent 30 years in Texas prisons. And the other one is my buddy Dave, who has been in and out of Texas prisons all of his life. So we each had very different experiences with the criminal justice system. We also have very different beliefs. I guess not extremely different, but we have different beliefs on about the ways to approach correcting it. But we all fundamentally believe that the first step that needs to happen for change to exist is that we need to change the way that people think about how we deal with crime in general. And so I wanted to do the podcast just to kind of tell the stories and to kind of give people an idea of what's going on in prison. And here's all these kind of crazy stories that happen and kind of given like behind the scenes look. And also to dive into some of these really deep, really kind of complicated things that you don't really understand are going on. One of the things I just did recently on the podcast was kind of talking about a topic that like what everyone gets wrong about crime. And that topic came up because I actually studied sociology and criminology while I was locked up. And there was a lot I just didn't understand. Like I didn't know about the history behind prisons, behind the justice system. One of the things I didn't know was this, or it was like some of the studies they've done. And that episode was specifically about one particular study that they've done over and over and over again. And it explains what works and what doesn't work. And it kind of shows you who's causing the majority of crimes. And I'm like, why does Why don't more people know about this? It's topics like that where I want to present these to people in general so they can look at them and get a better understanding of like, hey, that's okay. I didn't know that about the justice system, because before I got locked up, I never thought about the justice system at all. I just was like, bad people get locked up, they go away. Yeah. And I didn't understand that it's a far more complicated process. And it's not just about, it's not just a sole judgment on good or bad people. There's people with jobs, there's incentives for people, like the DA always has an incentive to lock someone up. There's not an incentive to give someone a pass, or to, if even if, you know, if the police find evidence or, you know, thinks that this is the right person, there's not an incentive to say, nope, that's not the right person. It's a whole different perspective once you're inside of it and a part of it. The only way I could see to break it down is to tell the stories and see, and like see the individual people, because that's kind of how I understood it, was through seeing the people and understanding each one of these topics.
Yeah. So when it comes to seeing people, that's what we do in coaching, right? We provide space for people to tell their stories in a space of non-judgment and be seen. And one of the things in grief and loss that I write about in my book about being seen is how hard it is to be seen in grief and for you to be vulnerable being seen in your pain. And I'm sure that can come up potentially in other spaces related to your work. So how did you grow in your journey to be seen in this field, to put yourself out there?
I'll put it this way. So coming out, being released from prison, one of the first things is I knew my mission even before getting locked up. I knew from the second, kind of after my first few days in jail, knew that I did not want someone to make the mistakes that I did. And then my life was going to follow some sort of path to try and prevent people from doing what I did. I knew when after prison, it was pretty clear that this is kind of where I was going. With that in mind, then the question came up. It comes to a really interesting story. When I was in treatment, after the accident, my lawyer said, you need to go to addiction treatment for drinking and things like that. And my lawyer's like, it's going to look good or whatever. Cause I'm like, at the time I was like, I don't need it. I just need to make sure I don't go to prison. But then once I went to treatment, I'm like, oh, this is where I need to be. I need all of this information. This is very useful because I have hit rock bottom. I am at a place that where I need the help. So when I was in treatment, there was another guy who was like me when I first came into treatment. Like, he's like, I've lost everything. I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to do it anymore. So I immediately rushed up to this guy and was like, hey, I've killed someone. You're going to be fine. They've got people who can help you here, and there's a lot you can do. And it's not even that bad. Like, what, you haven't even killed anyone. So you're fine. It's okay. And the counselor immediately after that interaction, like, he kind of swooped in. He's like, Hey Ryan, let me talk to you for a second. And he's like, that was a little much. That's kind of like, he wasn't super direct about it, but he's like, hey, you know, he's processing his own thing. He's dealing with it at his own pace. That's a lot to put on him right then and there. And I'm like, oh, I see. I can see it from my perspective, but I can't just automatically go and put all of my stuff on them. And that was one of the first things I was dealing with on prison, because coming out and saying, oh, I spent 6 years in prison, I killed a guy, blah, 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 that's a lot to put on someone in opening conversation saying that. If this is my mission now, I'm gonna have to say it a lot. So one of the hard parts is, when do I say this? When is it appropriate? When is there balance? I've had to slowly learn it. But one of the biggest part is accepting that I'm generally going to have to say this. And if I know I'm going to interact with someone more than once, really, this is going to come up. This is going to be a big thing. This is going to come up. This is going to be, just be ready that this is how it's going to be. And in general, if someone gets super curious around me, it's going to come up very quick, but I don't blurt it out first thing anymore. I might mention the parts of what I'm doing, the writing, the podcast, all of these things, but it'll be in stages. So that's one of the biggest things I had to learn, was figuring out, how can I frame this to people and put it out there so it's understanding? And also part of it too, is how do I make it so they're not automatically hostile to what I'm doing, like, that you're a criminal, you committed a crime, it's like, of course you don't like prison, but prison's not supposed to be a five-star resort, which is not what I'm saying either. I'm just trying to say no, but it can be moral. though. It can be something else. We can also try and help people, which ultimately, every time you help your fellow person, it helps you. And there's always, it's always trying to find ways to frame that. So one, I'm not trying to put stuff on them, and also not put them in the defense right off the bat.
There was so much in what you said about your story. And also, you had so many different awarenesses that were coming up in that story. The awareness of needing help. It was like, I had this really big experience. That's what I was getting from you. And so I don't need help because this kind of woke me up. But then when you went, you realize, oh, wait, I do need help. There is more work that needs to be done here. And it was the same awareness that you experienced when you told about the fact that, you know, you killed someone and then the counselor took you aside and said, that's a lot to put on another person. And it's not so much about you telling your story, but how you tell your story. And one thing that you said that was really interesting to me was the reframing. And given what you've been through, given that you were in a fatal crash that you were responsible for taking someone's life, those are heavy, heavy things. And I think a person could go many ways in this. They can go where they get very bitter or where they get very defensive, where they go in and they attack themselves. And they don't feel worthy of telling their story. They just become silenced. And I'm sure, Ryan, you've probably experienced this in the criminal justice system and in prison. You probably have met people who are just checked out. They don't really want feel like their voice matters. But what you did is very different, I think, in that you have taken this experience and you've made it a mission. You're very mission driven. And what is something that you can say to our listeners about reframing or being able to transform a terrible tragedy, a terrible and heavy, difficult situation into something that could become something good, where you're doing good, where you're putting out a podcast or creating, very creative as well. So any thoughts on that?
I would say the first step for me personally, and this first step, honestly, is something that I actually found out later, actually when I was in treatment, was popularized by like Viktor Frankl and by other very, I think it's in positive psychology, but they've done, it's very powerful, is to like find a purpose. First, if you can find a purpose and figure out where your purpose is, that will hold you. And Viktor Frankl, when he was writing about it, he was in the Holocaust and he figured out a purpose that kept him alive in far greater, harder circumstances than I was in. For me, I was in a circumstance of when I was sitting in jail, quickly recognized, like, I had a purpose before jail. My purpose before jail was, I'm going to be this awesome software developer. I'm going to start my own company. It's going to make millions of dollars. And I'm just going to shoot for the moon. But the thing is, being a software developer, you're going to have to I had to constantly stay on top of the newest thing and constantly keep practicing my skills and constantly keeping up that. But now I was sitting in jail. I had just killed someone. That was not going to happen. And I was like, I'm very likely going to go to prison for some amount of time. That's going to destroy any chances of that, whatever that was. So that's not my purpose. That is no longer my purpose. Like, that's out of my mind. So with that out of my mind, I had no more purpose. And when during that period, I was like, that was scary. It was scary. It was sad. And I didn't know what to do. And I could feel myself just getting more and more depressed. And so I had to make a conscious point. I'm like, okay, I'm depressed. what am I going to do? Am I going to keep going? Am I going to play this story out? Keep going all the way down this line and say, and just, if I'm going to just be depressed, mopey, do nothing, then it's the way it's going towards is it's going to be like, end with me killing myself, which is awful. It's like, is it really worth that? Do I really want, is it really that bad? And I'm sure people, as you said, people have gone to that extreme. And I was like, I don't want to, I didn't want to. So I'm like, okay, then I need a new purpose. I need to find something else from that. And that's when I came up, like, I don't want people. When I was sitting there looking back at all the decisions that had led to where I was at, I was like, I need to, if I can prevent that for something, someone else, that's where I want to be at. And so the next thing from there, I'm got out on bond and I'm going to treatment and things like that. But like, everyone's telling me, you're going to prison. The question is, how long? So I had that, like, I can't even start my life over at this point, knowing, like, I'm happy I'm not sitting in jail. I'm happy, like, I have a purpose. But I also know I'm going to prison. I don't know what prison's like. I don't know what's going on. I'm hearing firsthand accounts that are not great. And I'm scared. It's terrifying. And I've got to figure out what I'm going to, how to just let go day to day at this point. And the thing that I did, and a thing that I think people can do to help reframe in these, and like these hard moments, because there's, everyone has moments where it's like tough. Just remember, one, it can always be worse. The fact that you have the choice to even like sit there and think about it means that you have something. You have something that you can go from. So it's, you're not at the absolute bottom. And what do you want to do with it? And what do you want from it? And then one of the things that I was taught from the beginning is just go through, and as hard as it might be at that moment, just think of 5 things that you're grateful for. And if you can do that by the end of that, usually if I'm like really down and really beat up, by the time of me listing 5 things that I'm grateful for, then I kind of start kicking myself. I'm like, all right, I guess it's not that bad. It's like, it's not even when, and that was even with the prison coming up. And like, when my thing was the image that I always kept on using when I was waiting out on bond, I was like, at least I'm not in prison. All right. So I can enjoy what I've got now. At least I'm not in prison. I was in prison. I'm like, it's X number of days till I get out, or, you know, I got to work hard so I can get there as soon as possible. And the longer and longer I was in there, it's like, well, now, like, at first it was like, there's X number of days. It seemed like that's the hardest part, is really the beginning. But then once you built up some time, then you're like, oh, I've already done a year. I've already done 2 years. I've already done 3 years. Oh, I'm almost eligible for parole. And it gets closer, and biggest thing, if it gets to the point where you're really struggling, reach out to people, reach out to the people you care about, find people. The one thing that I had the hardest trouble doing, like, it was really hard for me to do while I was locked up. And the thing that is really easy to do, maybe not easy, but is a lot more accessible outside, is to find people that you trust, that you know will support you, and reach out to them and just say, hey, I'm going through it. You know, just tell me something good. Tell me it's going to be all right. For most people, there's usually someone in their life that is willing to do that and to give them that feedback. If not, I will. That's fine. I'll be that guy.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, relying on that community support was so helpful, along with your own, you know, will to find strategies that worked for you, like your gratitude practice working for you and other things such as that. And I know we spent the first half of the podcast mostly focused on kind of the internal and some of the strategies. So I'm wondering if we can continue that and find a way to segue into the external, like the systems and the restorative justice piece. So one of the questions I guess I have is, I know you did a lot of studying and learning about criminal justice and continue to do that work. What are some things our listeners could know about how to maybe be better advocates for this system, or how we can better support those who may be going through the criminal justice system?
So one of the things I didn't know about before I got locked up, and I found out about as I was learning, studying criminology, was about restorative justice. So the way the criminal justice system normally works, and you kind of get an idea of it from like Law and Order shows, though Law and Order is to like the law the same way Star Trek is to space. All right, you're not going to get a very accurate view of what's happening. The system is kind of, it's competitive. All right, either the prosecution wins or the defense wins. There's no, the judge can decide sort of halfway measures and things like that, but it's guilty or innocent. There's not a middle ground. And also, there's only certain things that a judge or, I mean, sometimes the judge has a lot of leeway on deciding what the sentence is going to be. But there's really usually only a few things they can offer. They can offer jail or prison time. They can offer fines. Sometimes they can offer like classes that are like run by the state, or they might offer restitution or like civil fines or things like that, but it's very, very limited. Oh, and community service. All right. And community service, depending on your jurisdiction, that's another aspect of it. Each jurisdiction is very different. The sentencing, the types of crimes that they focus on, all very different. If you're a victim of a crime, someone just robbed you, you've just lost a loved one, someone's just been hurt, putting someone away for a long time is not necessarily the first thing on your list. Really isn't the first thing on your list of things that you need at that moment. You might need to go to the hospital. You might need counseling. You may need to have funeral costs. You may need to be reimbursed for whatever items were stolen, or you might need them back, or you might need someone to clean up all the graffiti that's just been put up all over the school. You need a lot of things that have nothing to do with incarceration. You need a lot of things that have nothing to do with giving someone a criminal record. Those things don't really help. So with restorative justice, there is nothing that's really off the table. It's up to the victim to basically decide, and that really any of the community that's hurt, they can come to an agreement about what they want, what they need. And usually it's run by like here in Longmont, there's Longmont Community Justice Project, and they are community justice partners, and they will do this for like juvenile and sometimes like low-level nonviolent offenses. And it's kind of up to the police to hand them the cases to work on. Sometimes they'll even do this mediation type work for like offices and things like that too. And they will they'll talk to the victim, they'll talk to the offender, and at each stage, each group can kind of work with them to figure out where is this going to go. Where does it work out? Mediators just relays, and they work together as a team to figure out what this is going to look like. They don't just immediately grab the offender and grab the victim and put them in a room together and go hash it out. That is dangerous. And it's not like this person assaulted me and I don't want to ever see that person again. That's an option. That's totally on the board. Whatever boundaries each person wants to put up, that's an option. Sometimes people have been hurt, like the only way to get justice requires them to go to a courtroom. And so having an option where they don't have to do that, they don't have to see the offender, but they can work with someone to get what they need. And it's also up to them what they need. It's up to them if they want the counseling or they need the hospital bills or whatever. And then they can say, I want reimbursement from the person who hurt me. And if the person who hurt them is saying, I did it. Yes, I am responsible and I will do it. And I will work with these people to do it. Then it works out. It's now they've taken responsibility and they are helping out, trying to make amends to this person. And in the process I went through, one of the biggest things that stuck out to me was that by the end of it, I felt like I had hurt the victim's family more by the end of it, by going through sentencing, and from the beginning, I tried to take ownership, tried to say, I never denied what I was doing. The only thing I was trying to do was not spend the rest of my life in prison. That's the only thing I was trying to do. And if there was a process available where it was that someone had said to me, hey, this is a list of everything the victim wants. They want you to pay for funeral costs. They want you to do this. They need you to expressly take responsibility. They need you to, you know, do all like a laundry list of things that would show that I am trying to make amends. I would love that. That's what I wanted from the beginning, was to try and make amends to them. The state of Texas, I didn't feel like I needed to make amends to. It was to that family. And in the end, I feel like I just kept on doing more and more harm. And I feel like that keeps happening over. I feel like that happens every day. And restorative justice is a way that the victims can actually get help and decide what terms they want. So people looking to actually help victims, I feel like restorative justice is a great thing to look up. Look at restorative justice policies and like supporting those groups in your area. And also, I advocate, my thing is, in general, restorative justice would never be used in a case like mine, in a violent case. But I feel like it's actually more powerful in cases like this. There are many stories of cases where victims have gone out on their own, not using restorative justice, and contacted the people who have hurt them. And through their own like process, have found healing. But I feel like it could have happened much sooner had there been a healthy restorative justice process that guided them through it for that. And it could help. And ultimately, the really big thing is, I feel like it could help prevent further crime. And because one of the biggest things I find out that, like I said, from that video about what everyone gets wrong about crime is, the harder you punish crime, the more likely people are going to do it. And restorative justice is not about punishing, it's about healing. And the more you heal a person, the less likely they are to do it. And that is key to preventing what's going to happen next.
I really like what you said about healing. I think that's so important. I do, from my own observation, I have family members who have been through the criminal justice system. And I have felt that that is one part of the criminal justice system that is missing, and that is the healing. It's so important. And I'm curious to know more on your end, Ryan, about the healing. And this is entirely up to you if you feel comfortable talking about it. You did mention that you felt like you had done more harm to the family of the person who lost their life as a result of the crash. And if you could just say more about what you perceive to be harmful to them, it could just be the system itself going through the whole trial, reliving things in a way that's not gentle and is not looking towards healing and isn't compassionate on all sides, I would say. So if you could say more about that, I would love to hear more, and I'm sure our listeners would as well.
Absolutely. So what happened? So basically, I got out when I got out on bond. The way, let's go through a little bit of the process. I got locked up. I went to jail first, after the accident. And then from jail, I had to pay a bond, which my lawyer put up for me. And the lawyer, and then once I got out, my lawyer like told me, all right, this is the conditions of your bond. Your parents are going to take you back to Colorado. And then once I got back to Colorado, then I went to treatment and did my time on Colorado. Now he's like, there's a long list of things that are going to happen in that time. Your case, he's like, your case typically is going to be like, it's to get it to trial is going to be probably from 6 months to 2 years. It's about the average for your type of case. So he's like, that's basically how long I'm going to be out on bond. She said, so he was trying to like expectations set for me. She says, you're going to be 6 months to 2 years. And probably several times in between then, you're going to have to come back to Texas to go to court. And then when for your final, whatever hearing it is, depending on if you're going to fight it, you're going to have to come back and do a special hearing for that. And then whatever, if you get sentenced, you're going to have to come back for a hearing for that. And then after that, if you get sentenced, you're very likely you're going to go to prison. And then you're going to spend X number of years in prison. And this is your minimum sentence is 2 years for this offense. And maximum is 20. So, he was very clear. This county, the county I was in, which was one of like the wealthiest counties outside of Dallas, it's like, they do not like drunk driving offenses. Do not take kindly to them. And very clear. And I looked up the history on it. They do not like drunk driving. I did not find a case where they had ever issued the minimum or done what the next county over did, which was gave people probation instead of prison. So that was what I was facing at the time. So I, from the beginning, said, I'm guilty. I'm guilty. And everyone's like, and I asked, I'm like, is there any reason I shouldn't say I'm guilty? He's like, it's up to you, which is a sign of a bad attorney. Many attorney says, it's up to you. No, they need to give you all the reasons why. It's really not good to say that you're guilty because of the next phase that's going to happen, which is the DA. Most people don't go to a hearing. They get a plea deal. If you say not guilty, the DA, then you have something to barter with the DA, and say, then the DA can say, if you plead guilty, then I'll reduce the sentence for you. And since I didn't do that, he's like, 15 years. That's all I can give you. And I didn't want 15 years in prison. So what I had to do then was have a sentencing hearing. And the sentencing hearing, which meant paying my lawyer a lot more to go to this hearing, meant that the victims and everything were coming, because they're going to come and usually they're coming to protest generally or be witnesses. One of the victims' family was a witness. Then one decided to become a witness at the end of it, because they were so upset. There's a sentencing hearing to decide what my sentence is going to end up being. That took a year to get to that point. So basically, from the time, I'd say probably about 4 months in, or actually probably even earlier than that, it was probably about 2 or 3 months in, I said, I would really like to apologize to the family and tell them that I'm sorry. And my lawyer outright said, multiple times. That is a bad idea. Do not recommend it. Can only do harm. It's only going to hurt you if you do that. So said it multiple times, basically making it clear, not going to happen. Okay. Not going to happen. So this entire time, family hasn't heard anything from me, only that I'm taking this thing to a sentencing hearing. That's all they really, they know I killed their son and I'm taking this to a sentencing hearing. That's all they know about me. And they have the whole records of everything they did that night on the worst night of my life. So they have, that's the summary of all they know about me at this point. All right. And they've sat on that for a year before they get to this hearing. Get to the hearing, and now we get eyewitness testimony of all the horrible things I did that night, which plenty horrible to go around. Not going to deny that. And I had people who were in Colorado who wanted to say, like, they were going to write witness statements for me. Judge says, nope, not allowing it. So a lot of people had written witness statements already because they normally accept it. Nope, judge denied all of it. I had people who had flown out, came out there with me, and they had sat on the stand for me, did that. All right, they finally called me. I'm supposed to be the last person on the stand, and they brought me out on the stand. And my lawyer, who had prepped me for 2 hours, that's the amount of time he had prepped me for, he did not tell me that he was going to ask me this question. He said, you've been asking to apologize to this family now. We'll go, or you've been asking to talk to this family for so long now. Say what you want to say. And one thing about me that I had learned from treatment is that when I am under a serious amount of stress, I'm just going to disassociate. I'm just going to not be present anymore. And that's when he said that, I just left the room and my mouth just went on. I don't know what I said. I definitely did not want, I knew before I went into that courtroom, I wasn't going to say I'm sorry, because a courtroom is not the place to say I'm sorry, period. Like, that's not a good way. That's a very hollow apology to say it right in the middle of a courtroom. Feels very forced. And also the thing I repeat over and over again, it's like, I don't know how to apologize for it. I just killed someone. So that, all of that, all tied together into all putting that in front of the family that's been dragged from their homes to this courtroom, to see there, all of that, to be next to this monster that they've been sitting around thinking about for a year that took their son. All of that caused, I watched that family cry and stare at me in the courtroom. And it was heartbreaking, not for me. I mean, it was for me, but like for everyone in that room. I feel like so much damage was done just in that sentencing hearing. I don't feel like they got atonement, which is what they really wanted. They didn't get their apology, which they will never get, unfortunately, because as was made clear that day, I don't think they want to ever think about me again. And fair. And so I think of all the things that could have possibly helped, possibly healed, possibly tried to move forward, none of that was authored. Instead, after that whole part where I was disassociating, all that kind of stuff, the DA came up and pointed out every awful thing I said during that last part, including how I didn't apologize. And then I watched, as the DA is talking, I'm watching the mom break down into tears. And it's just a lot of hurt. Whereas if this was a restorative justice process, the whole point is to not to proactively hurt people like that. It's not about winning a case. It's not about getting the most time. Because the DA, the benefit of her doing that, the benefit of her going through and bringing up all the awfulness in front of the judge and in front of the courtroom, is that if she gets me locked away for, and she got me with a 20-year sentence because I did get 10 years prison plus 10 years probation, which is unheard of anywhere. I've never heard anyone with a first-time offense that got that level of sentencing. There are people who've gotten, it's a very convoluted sentence. It's especially been tricky coming to Colorado with that sentence. But that sentence goes on her record as a big win, especially since that she was one of the new DAs. So that's one of her, she's a new DA, and that goes in as a big win, as one of her first wins on her record. Whereas restorative justice, there's no incentive for anyone to do that, to break the communication down, to cause anyone pain like that. The incentive is for everyone to work together in a restorative circle. And there's one other thing I would say too. There's one other form of justice I didn't bring up too that I really think is really important, which is transformative justice. Transformative justice, whereas restorative justice works on the individual group, transformative justice will actually go one step further and go, okay, what actually caused the harm? Like, what is there a systemic thing that's causing the harm? Is everyone robbing the same liquor store because they can't find a job that pays above minimum wage in this area? How do we get more jobs into this area to fix that problem? Or do we need to raise minimum wage, or do we need to like do something else to make sure this happens? And this is like, this situation with the DA is a situation where I feel like transformative justice is like what we really need to ensure that we don't have adversarial situations like this. We need to transform how we're dealing with these situations so that we're not sentencing offenders and then hurting victims at the same time.
Yeah, thank you for sharing the complexity of all that. And it's a good tie-in to where we're headed as we go into the end of our episode today. And we always impart our listeners with a coaching nugget of wisdom. So something that kind of has been a theme that might get distilled down from today's episode. Ryan, you're more than welcome to share coaching nugget of wisdom too. So I'll give you time to kind of process that. But I think my coaching nugget of wisdom from what I have gathered today is there's so much richness in coming together through conversation and, you know, really telling our stories authentically and also using our journeys in a way to bring hope and healing. So those are some of the themes that I captured today. And I think those are nuggets that we can continue to use in our own lives and in the listeners' lives as well. So I'll pass it over to LaShawn and see what she wants to add from there.
There's so much richness in this conversation. Ryan, I really want to express my appreciation for your openness, telling your story, and being so clear about the complexities of the criminal justice system, as I kind of choke on the word justice when I say that. and the story itself, I think, really speaks to itself. When we are dealing with harm, when there is something that needs to be healed, I want to put out there that it's really important to, one, give yourself and the people involved the space to, you know, process the hurt and allow the healing to come in. And I think that there's a lot of room that we have for transforming the way that we respond to harm, especially if it's harm that's done, maybe not intentionally, but it's as a result of someone's actions. And I want to invite our listeners to think about all of the things that are in play when there is something that happens, someone is injured, when someone needs to be healed, and what we can do in terms of giving ourselves the space to feel that and process it. And as a society, give ourselves that time and space, and also utilizing the people who understand these processes, who understand restorative justice, who understand transformative justice, and making room for that and calling for that and speaking for that. So Ryan.
I want to kind of follow up with what you're saying. The thing is, when you're harmed, or when someone is in general harmed, it is 100% understandable, acceptable, human to you are allowed and to be hurt, to have whatever feelings you have inside to react to that. You can be angry, hurt, whatever comes from that. And I do not blame anyone for having any of those feelings. And just as if someone unjustly took my parking space in front of the building and I got out and decided I'm going to punish them, that punishment is not necessarily the right answer in the situation. And honestly, time and time again, we find out punishment doesn't really work all that great. Because punishment is not good at changing people's behavior. It's just good at blowing off some steam. And even then you have to deal with the blowback from the punishment. So it's okay. Whatever you're feeling from whatever someone does something to you unjustly, everyone is entitled to their feelings. And as a society, we have to figure out, how do we react? How do we help the people who have been hurt and heal everyone involved, and figure out how do we make us all safer? Because right now, throwing everyone together and just hoping for the best has not been working. Has really, really not been working.
We have been talking to Ryan Forbes, a writer, podcaster, and he speaks for the people who do not have voice in the, who are incarcerated. And Ryan, can you just tell our listeners really quick before we wrap this up where they can find you?
Yes. If you are looking for me, you can find me at waywardpress.com. That's like a way with words, waywordpress.com. And you can find my graphic novel there. You can order a print copy if you'd like. You can find The Shakedown there, or you can go to youtube.com/@getTheShakedown and watch some crazy videos and some interesting conversations, or go to @GetTheShakedown on whatever social media platforms you use.
Thank you again, Ryan.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for Coaching as Benevolence. I'm LaShawn with Maychelle Sage Place, Positive Intelligence Coaching.
And I'm Erin with Roots and Wings, Grief and Loss Coaching.
Have a benevolent day.